The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Richard Lee.
Are you here for the Guardian First Book Award? Please come this way.
We're here at Tate Modern to find out who's won the 2013 Guardian First Book Award, a prize which pits fiction against non-fiction, poetry and drama to find the year's most exciting debut. It's chosen by a panel of judges, including Philip Hensher, Rachel Cusk and the editor of Guardian Review, Lisa Allardyce. But the shortlist is selected with the help of reading groups up and down the country. Let's see what they made of this year's entry.
From Edinburgh. In fact, it is our shortlist. So we're absolutely thrilled about it.
So did you have a favourite book amongst you?
Burial Rise.
Burial Rise, yeah.
It was just so beautifully written. It really was so evocative of the time, the place, and she really made you feel that you were there. She knew about that place and could really introduce you to her characters in a very subtle, very deep way, we felt. You know, as the family got to know the central character, we, you know, individually got to know her as well. And personally, I didn't mind at the end whether she was guilty or not. I still felt the same for her. So.
I like The Spinning Heart. I thought it was really wonderfully written. And I loved the way that the story sort of gradually came out of everybody's own story. Each chapter was the story of each character. The writing was beautiful, the dialect was lovely, you know, it was just really so well written. I couldn't believe it was the first book.
London.
But did you have a favourite book amongst the group?
Oh, I did, yes, The Don O'Ryan.
And what's that book like?
Absolutely superb. Very original writing, I think, and very evocative.
Did you all like Don O'Ryan's book?
Oh, I loved him. Loved him so much. And I've actually gone on to buy his second book from Ireland. It's not even out in the UK. It's that good, yeah.
Do you think it wasn't unanimous.
Who do you think is going to win?
We'd like to say Donald. We think it's either going to be Hannah Kent or Noviolet Bulawayo. Yeah.
Oxford. The shortlist was exactly the shortlist that we chose, so we're thrilled with the shortlist.
Was there a particular book on the list which you liked yourself?
Burial Rites was my favourite, yes.
By Hannah Kent?
Yes, that's right. It moved me, so by the end of it, I actually cried.
I liked The Spinning Heart because it was so cleverly written. The different chapters started fitting together so very well. It was very well thought out and very well written.
And I think The Spinning Heart was a fantastic book. Really glad I read it.
Ryan and Kent are joined on the shortlist by Noviolet Bulawayo's story of migration, We Need New Names, Shireen El Faki's study of relationships in the Arab world, Sex in the Citadel, and Lottie Mogak's internet identity thriller, Kiss Me First.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage editor of Guardian Review and chair of the judges, Lisa Allardyce.
I'd just like to say how proud and grateful I am to work for a paper that not only does the things that it does so bravely and brilliantly, you know, phone hacking, NSA, etc., but that also takes literature so seriously and has writers and writing so close to its heart. The prize is in its 15th year, and we should all give a really big round of applause to Claire Armitstead, who did a wonderful job of establishing the award. The Guardian First Book Award champions new writing across all genres, politics, history, biography, fiction, you name it, we read it. And while this is very rewarding, it does mean that there comes a point in every judging lunch, and this year was no exception, that somebody mentions apples and pears and things get a little bit sticky, but it is one of the things that makes the prize very unique. Previous winners include writers now as well known as this year's Booker Chair, Robert McFarlane, Jonathan Safran Foer, Chris Ware, and of course, right back, a very young Zadie Smith for White Teeth. And I'm thrilled that I think we not only have previous judges here this evening, but some past winners too. So welcome and thank you to all of you. The winner will receive £10,000 plus an advertising package in The Guardian and Observer newspapers. Please welcome Waterstones' Stuart Broom, representative of the reading groups, who's going to do the important bit.
I ought to thank the other judges, and that includes the nearly 40 readers and booksellers, who are many of whom are here tonight, other than the Leeds group, who are in a railway siding. Those five groups met at Waterstones starting in late September and set their minds into looking at that most tricky of things, what makes a terrific debut. What are the hallmarks of a writer at this stage of her career, or his, that gives you the confidence that there's more to say, that there's more to come? It's an important thing to consider. We did find cause for celebration in the work of all of those writers. But what we discovered in the winner was a writer whose sureness of style, boldness with narrative, and sheer humanity makes them a worthy champion. The Guardian First Book Award of 2013 goes to Donal Ryan for The Spinning Heart.
My God, I really, genuinely can't believe it. And I really can't. I know everybody says it, but I really, really can't. This is a glorious moment in my life, but not the easiest. And maybe partly because I'm Irish, I have an innate fear of standing out. My fellow writers will know what I mean when I talk about fear. When I say that of the many obstacles that stand in the way of a first book as it makes its precarious way into the world and into its readers' hands, fear is often the biggest and the most difficult to surmount. Fear of not being good enough, of not being able properly to say what we mean, fear of rejection, fear of harsh judgment, fear of having our work taken from us and changed into something we never intended it to be, and ironically, for me at least, fear of not standing out. And it's my pleasure to dedicate it with all my love to Anne-Marie, my wife. Thank you.
I was as smart as any of the posh lads in school. I was well able for the English and geography and history. All those equations in physics and maths made sense to me. I couldn't ever let on I knew anything, though. That would have been suicide in my gang. I did pass maths, even though I knew I could have done honours. I never opened my mouth in English. A lad from the village wrote an essay one time, and Pawsey Rogers praised him from a height. He said it showed great flair and imagination. He got kicked the whole way back to the village. I had that King Lear's number from the start, well before the teacher started to break things down slowly for the tick lads. He was a stupid prick. He had it all and wanted more. He wanted the whole world to kiss his arse. I had Goneril and Regan pegged for bitches too, and I knew that Cordelia was the one who really, truly loved him. She wouldn't lie to him, no matter how much he wanted her to. "You're a man and no more," she said. "You're not perfect, but I love you." Cordelia was true of heart. There aren't many Cordelias in this world. Trina is one. I was scared before I knew I was of facing down Josie Burke, and she told me. I was scared, imagine, even though I was in the right. Pokey Burke left his father and mother to mop up after him. The old lad said he didn't know where Pokey was, but I knew he was lying. "He owes me money, Josie," I said. "Oh, does he now? Did he not pay you a fine wage?" He was looking down at me from the third step before his front door. I might as well have had a cap in my hand and called him sir. My stamp, my pension, my redundancy. I could hear my own voice shaking. "Your out of state looks after all that when fellas goes bust," he said. "Go in as far as town to the dole office." He said no more, only kept looking down at me, down along his nose. Right so, I will. I didn't say I'd been there already. We all had. And it turned out Pokey had rowed us up the creek and left us there. I should have said I'd been on to the taxmen and the welfare inspectors and the unions, and they'd soon soften Pokey's cough. But I hadn't, and I didn't. And I turned away with a pain in my heart for the man I'd thought I was. Trina said, "Don't mind them, love. Don't think about them. The Burkes were always users and crooks, dressed up like the salt of the earth. Everyone's seen their real faces now. The whole village knows what they've done. You're a worker, and everyone knows it. People look up to you. They'll be fighting each other to take you on once things pick up. Everyone round here knows you're the only one can keep the reins on them madmen. Who else could be a foreman over the lads around here? Who else could knock a day's work out of fat Rory Slattery and stop Shawnee Shaper from trying to get off with himself. I laughed then through my invisible tears. I couldn't stand myself. I couldn't stand her smiling through her fear and having to coax me out of my misery like a big, sulky child. I wish to God I could talk to her the way she wants me to, besides forever making her guess what I'm thinking. Why can't I find the words? Right so, right so, right so. Imagine being such a coward and not even knowing it. Imagine being so suddenly useless.
Ryan Langan, Ryan's editor at Doubleday Island, knew as soon as he set eyes on the manuscript of The Spinning Heart that it was something special.
Well, it was on the slush pile, as they call it. It's one of those things that is very rare to find such a gem. Our first impressions were amazement that for a debut novel could have such amazing power of language. From the very first paragraph just captured me, and I knew this was a really, really special book. And particularly for ourselves in Doubleday Ireland, it was actually the first book on our Doubleday Ireland literary imprint. It's a dream for an editor.
A writer like this, you start asking yourself, what can he do?
Actually, just about to publish in the UK, his second novel, The Thing About December, it just come out in Ireland, great reviews. You're just looking forward to Donal just hitting the stars, really.
For Allardyce's fellow judge, the novelist Philip Hensher, Donal Ryan is an extraordinary talent.
I thought it was a terrific winner. It's a technically interesting book. It's addressing all sorts of urgent questions, and it's found rather a brilliant means by which to do it. The 21 characters who never recur, who just speak for 800 words and then disappear into the ether. He's obviously thought very hard about what the novel can do. The sort of novel that you get a bit fed up of these days is the novel that seems like a halfway house to a major motion picture. This very much wasn't one of those. It was invested in its own form. It was invested in ways of talking. It was fascinated by the locality and by the humanity as well as by the larger situation. I was convinced that he'd actually started it by investigating individual human beings, and only after a while had come to the conclusion that he was saying something bigger about the world they lived in, which is the right way round to do it, I would say.
So was it his technical mastery, the kind of the mechanism, the way he managed it, which swung it for the panel?
No, I think in the end, you know, technical mastery is one thing, but I don't think that on its own would swing anybody's mind. It's just a case of a book that succeeds in speaking to you, I guess, and speaking with some sort of humanity. Of course, if a book speaks with humanity but it doesn't have the technical skill either, then, you know, that's not going to be much good either. So it was really the marriage of the two things, the humanity and the nascent, I would say, technical skill, because this is a writer at the beginning of a long journey.
Reading a book like this, I'm wondering if fiction can make us feel differently about the age of austerity.
Yes. Without the ability to read fiction, without the regular habit of reading novels, they're just statistics, they're just out there, they're just on the other side of the plate glass window. I would never, ever trust a politician, however well-meaning he claims to be, who says that he never reads novels.
Can you tell us about any tussles on the panel?
There's some books on the long list that I think we disagreed quite energetically about. On the short list, I think everyone saw the quality there. Obviously, at that point, you know, different tastes come in. And for me, the book that I rather loved, that I looked forward to the next book that she writes, is Lottie Mogacz's. I thought, you know, a lot of people have been trying to work out how to get online experience into fictional shape. It's very, very difficult because, you know, you're just losing all sorts of human gestures, all sorts of ways of talking that it's the meat and drink of the novel. And she found a very interesting way of doing it, and it was very compelling.
According to Waterstone's Stuart Broom, despite its intricate polyphonic construction, The Spinning Heart has been something of a hit with readers.
The Spinning Heart looks, it's a deceptive book because it looks like a very modest, slim, simple book. And in fact, it is large, various, filled with characters. And so it's got that immediate charm of being not probably what you expect it to be. And that is always going to be, in literary terms, a real hit with readers when they're getting something that's other than what they imagined.
How do they cope with the interlocking voices, the construction of it?
The interlocking voices make you work quite hard, but we have ambitious readers who like being challenged. So the readers like the challenge that can be set to them by a writer who says, okay, work with me on this. I'm not going to go back to any of these characters. I'm just going to place them in sequence and you are going to have to work out who's who. So, you know, it's like a very sophisticated Agatha Christie style thing in a way, when you actually have to do a lot of the mental work, although it's obviously a very different kind of book and rather sophisticated book, actually, and rather sure of itself. I think it was its confidence and its surety about its structure. You get very little sense of hesitation in this book, and that is always going to be a winner for readers when they've got that sense of being in a safe pair of hands.
What kind of effect does a prize like this have on the sales of a debut novel?
It has a big effect. I think Donal Ryan's would be a good example of one where it's already had quite a lot of support, and because it's a quality piece of work, but I suspect that it will really kind of find its market. And so the effect that the Guardian First Book Award has on sales is really significant. And it's nice when a book, you feel like it's found, it's almost like it's been fostered. It's sort of gone to its rightful home, it's found a champion, it's found the right place for it, and that's definitely the case with this novel.
How did you start writing A Spinning Heart? Were you already writing short stories?
Well, I actually had written pretty much a first draft of a novel before A Spinning Heart, and I thought to myself, I'd better stay going now while I have the kind of the momentum built up, because my wife's pregnant. Actually, we'd had our first child, and, you know, my window of opportunity day by day was getting narrower and narrower. So I said, okay, I'll stay going and do a second novel. And then I can say, you know, I've done it. I've written two novels, and whatever happens, at least I did what I said I would do. Because I always started writing novels all my life, and I'd get to a certain point, even sometimes close to a first draft, and I'd lose confidence completely in myself, and I'd just throw it away.
So what was the kernel? What was the idea?
I always had this kind of idea of writing a novel in the polyphonic form, with kind of lots of voices feeding into a kind of overall narrative. And I said, I'll just go for it, and I'll do the thing that I had in my mind to do for all these years. Because I had my confidence at a certain level from writing The Thing About December, and I wasn't in kind of a truck of despair, or, as you know, at a peak of overconfidence. I was at kind of a level place. So I said, well, I'm at this level place now, I'll stay writing.
Was it the voices that you followed? You just basically started with the first voice and carried going?
Yeah, I did. I started with Bobby, and I thought, I'll do it kind of in the Maeve Binchy style. Maeve Binchy had a lovely style of having maybe five or six main characters who would speak, you know, five or six times in a narrative. And Bobby said his piece, and then, you know, I had this kind of clamour of voices in my head. And some voices, like Lily, literally popped out of nowhere. It was as though she was a spirit, disembodied, who saw this going on and said, oh, this young fella's writing a book about people in a village. I'll get into this action, because Lily actually wrote herself, you know, and she appears in the book as she was written on a Saturday morning, you know, in my kitchen with Anne Marie gone to the shops, which is kind of amazing. But I started to hear this clamour of voices in my head and people shouting to get out onto the page. It was amazing.
There's a lot of anger, a lot of bitterness at the human cost of economic disaster, at the eternal struggle of family conflict. Was it written out of anger?
You know, it's funny because I've seen The Spinning Heart described as a hyper-real novel, but in a way it's not, because Irish people tend not to speak so frankly. We tend to bottle things up and maybe be a little bit passive-aggressive. You know, we might let go after about a year of frustration, start shouting and, you know, going mad. But I know there was a lot of anger in it. And, you know, the anger in the book is kind of aimed in different directions. Mostly poor Pokey, who's a bit of a victim as well, because guys like Pokey really got too big for their boots because they were given the equipment to do so by people far above them in financial terms, you know, who literally inflated this bubble, knowing it was a bubble and knowing it would burst, you know, with disastrous effect.
Is the novel a good place to try and say the unsayable?
I didn't really think out that too much as I was starting. And then the voices kind of took over. So people started to say things. And I said, well, I'm not going to start editing, you know, people's frustrations, because I suppose there are a lot of things in the book that you will hear people saying in Ireland, you know, on radio shows and in private conversations, a lot more now, because we've started to really speak out in Ireland now, you know. I mean, the fear that was always there as I talked about earlier, of sending out, is starting to kind of dissipate a little bit, you know, and we are, people, we realise in many ways, economically, we've been conned. With some people, it's kind of a murderous rage. With others, it's just annoyance, you know. So there's different levels of frustration and bitterness about it, yeah.
I'm wondering if this feeling of bottling everything up and then letting it all come out, in fiction, if that might be a reason why Irish writers are so strong at fiction.
Yeah, I think so. It's almost as though it was developed as a channel for the things that the country wanted to say, but didn't really, you know, have the wherewithal or the equipment or the chance to say it. Yeah, sometimes it does feel as though Irish novelists and playwrights and poets are kind of mouthpieces for the whole nation, and not always in a positive way, for the nation's less positive feelings. Yeah,
as a country boy yourself, do you feel the constrictions of rural life? I mean, the lad getting kicked the whole way back to the village after writing an essay, or the crazy old bint starting all that old talk about the affair. Do you feel those kind of that smallness yourself?
Yeah, you can see sometimes, you know, in villages, everybody watching everybody, and there being a kind of a pervasive sense of fear about life, you know, about living your life and about being really who you are. A lot of those things people are saying they wouldn't admit to, you know. Seanie Shaper probably wouldn't admit to the despair he feels, to the depression he feels, because he equates, you know, the actual clinical depression with just being a mentor, you know, with some kind of weakness. So Seanie isn't the kind of guy who'll say this. In real life, Seanie would be a laconic guy who'd bottle things up. He'd have a laugh at the guys. We often use humour in almost an aggressive way in Ireland, as a way of kind of venting our frustrations, but we kind of frame it in humour.
Did you set out to kind of turn over some of the myths of country life? The idea that you know, we're a well-knit community, we'll look after each other?
Yeah, you know, sometimes I read back and I talk to people and I feel a slight guilt about that, because, I mean, the village where I grew up, Newtown, was a really beautiful place. But people are people no matter where they are. You know, I mean, there are villages and cities. You know, you can have, you know, a company where you work can be in many ways function like a village. You know, you've got different characters, disparate people, you know, people living closely together, not getting on, you know, but having to live together, and it can be explosive.
So, your characters don't seem to have very much time for the consolations of religion.
It just seemed to me that kind of the Catholic Church and priests, and especially parish priests, got such a hard time in Irish fiction. I said, I'll leave it alone, because, you know, for me personally, my experience of religion and of priests was always positive. But I know about the darkness that was there, and the horrible cover-ups and the horrible behaviour. But, I mean, you know, there's bad behaviour in all walks of life. But I said, I'd kind of step back from it a little bit, because it was done so much.
The novel's also just a little bit suspicious about art, about the novel, that it doesn't quite measure up to life properly. Is that a suspicion that you share?
Yeah, because it's always going to be, no matter how directly you write, you know, it'll always be an oblique representation of reality. And I did struggle with that. I tried to narrow the gap as much as possible between the reader and the word on the page, so that I tried to get it so that the reader was almost immersed in these words, and it was like they were actually in a room with the person, and the words were all around them. They were hearing these words. And I kind of had a vision in my head of the reader as a priest in a confessional, where there's a black veil and you can barely see the person talking, but you can hear the words very clearly, and they're talking straight off from their soul.
Yeah, and that was something that you thought would give you a kind of depth, a kind of truth.
My overriding aim, really, writing Spinning Heart, was to say things that were true.
Your second novel, The Thing About December, is just out in Ireland. Should your readers this side of the water be expecting another slice of post-crash despair?
Well, it's more pre-crash despair, really, because it's set in 2001. So I suppose the books kind of bookended the whole thing, you know, because, you know, one, the bubble in Ireland was starting to inflate. You know, we'd gone through 4 or 5 years of positive growth that was based on, you know, having a highly educated, motivated workforce and having indigenous industry and foreign investment, to this huge, crazy, freakish bubble in land prices. And the thing about December deals with that. It's the same village, and a guy in the village inherits land that is rezoned, making it notionally, you know, worth multiples of its original worth. He's a notional multimillionaire, and this mad pressure comes to bear on him. And of course, writing it, I thought, this is completely original. This is an unbelievably good idea. But I mean, it's been done since I wrote it. You know, there have been novels and plays with the exact same premise, because it happened so much, you know. This did happen to people. You know, people were sitting on 40-acre farms, all of a sudden worth millions. And it must have caused unbelievable upheaval and trauma in their lives.
Yeah. So what you wrote The Thing About December a bit first, didn't you? First. Yeah. And so what are you writing now? Are you leaving Boom and Bust behind?
I kind of am, all right. I'm writing a novel from a female perspective. It's in the same village, but, you know, I say if it's okay for Faulkner, it's okay for me. But yeah, the recession is kind of very, very much in the background in this new book. I don't know if I should say it, but it's a very happy ending to the next book.
The winner of the 2013 Guardian First Book Award, Donal Ryan. We'll be back next week with a look at Christmas books for both children and grown-ups. Track us down by searching for Guardian Books Podcast. You can listen online, follow us on SoundCloud, or subscribe via iTunes.
Until then, from me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Tim Mabey, thanks for tuning in.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.